This is Weekday. I'm Steve Scheer. Comedian George Carlin's new book, Brain Droppings, is dedicated to his big brother, Patrick, who he writes was kind enough to teach him attitude. Considering the thing Carlin writes, his brother must be one ornery person. George Carlin has been performing for over 40 years. Long after other comedians have shot through the stratosphere and landed back on Earth, Carlin is still spinning out theories about the first human sacrifice and compiling lists of redundancies, unnecessary words, and people who should be phased out. George Carlin has won 2 Grammys, 2 Cable Ace Awards, been in 9 movies, and written and performed 9 solo HBO comedy specials. His book is Brain Droppings. He joins us on Weekday. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Did your brother really teach you attitude?
Well, it was, I picked it up. I'll put it that way. Teach is probably a stretch. But he had, the biker initials FTW?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's my brother all over. So I kind of picked up my version of that.
Well, we'll get back to that because I'd be curious about how that would be the case. I guess it's always that way in families, though, isn't it? There's always somebody else in a family that you sort of learn from.
Well, in this case, we were the only children. He was 5 years older than I, and our father was gone, and our mother was at work all day. So even though we didn't hang out with the same group of guys, we were in the same neighborhood where everyone knew everyone else, and he was a bit of a minor legend. So I emulated him in certain ways. I wasn't a fighter. He was a good fighter, but we could both dance well. And we both were kind of fearless when it came to doing stupid things. You know how that is.
Like what?
Oh, hitching on trucks and stealing things, breaking into places, stealing microscopes out of Columbia University. Whatever was, anything that wasn't tied down, we took it.
You stole microphones out of Columbia?
Microscopes.
Microscopes?
Yeah, out of Pupin Laboratories, where the original Manhattan Project was centered. And if they'd had an atom bomb lying around, I think we'd have gotten one.
Were you selling them?
No. We were always proud, though, that in later years, after the two of us had gotten into early adulthood, that Columbia started to put bars on the windows of a lot of their places.
You could say that was
their first. Yeah, we felt that was directly responsible. We were directly responsible for that.
A minor legend. He was a minor legend.
Sure, it's George, your brother, man. He's crazy. That sort of thing. Your brother, man. He's the weirdest guy. He's crazy, Georgie. And the opposite was true. Hey, Pat, Georgie's really nuts, man. it's just. Two people who stood out. We had a good gift of gab, and we were jive guys,
And dancers.
Good dancers. Fast dance. Lindy, Savoy, fast dancing.
Because that's what kids were doing back then?
Well, too slow and a fast, too slow and a fast, too slow and a fast, one mambo. That's how you run a dance.
Did you used to do that? Did you guys run dances or go to dances?
No, I ran. When I was in sixth grade, my brother would have been somewhere in high school. And at our grammar school, Corpus Christi, where we both attended grade school, was also the church and everything built into one, as it is with Catholic parishes in the East especially. They started having dances for the high school age kids. And he was somehow on the committee. I will never understand that. But he was somehow involved with the planning. And he said, Georgie, you want to play the records for the dance? And I said, yeah, because I loved records. I loved music. And I was just crazy about anything that seemed like show business. Anything that even glanced off of show business was of interest to me. So I said, yeah. He says, it's $1. It's $1 a night and all the Cokes you can drink and whatever broad you can grab. Well, I'm in the sixth grade, and so the broad thing wasn't part of it. But playing the records and drinking the Coke, I developed, really a fierce case of Coca-Cola acne on this job with free Cokes. But, Georgie, too slow and a fast, too slow and a fast, too slow and a fast, then you play a mambo.
So where is he today?
My brother's in Ventura County. He writes. He hasn't had a wildly successful record of being published, but he's a happy man. He's a good writer. He's an interesting guy, and he's my brother, and we see each other all the time.
George Carlin is our guest. This this book of Brain Droppings has a lot of things. I just want to read a few to you and have you just go over them with me a little bit because
– Alrighty.
I just wondered. And people who should be phased out.
Mm-hmm.
Guys who always harmonize the last few notes of Happy Birthday.
Yeah, it's time for these guys to leave.
That's it?
It's it. That's all. See, so, some things don't require a whole lot of real – what else do you need to say about those guys right at the end? But just the last few notes. You want to get clever, start in, sing some country thirds. Let me hear you. Go home, rehearse a while. Let me hear something interesting.
Guys who flash me the thumbs up sign, especially if they're – Especially they're winking and making the peace sign with their other hand.
Well, that's the accumulated one from the two others. Guys who wink at you when they're kidding, these guys I can do without. And then the guys who give you the peace sign and really mean it, I just have trouble with that. So a guy who's winking, giving you thumbs up and the peace sign and all these other indicators, come on, talk to me. Use the voice.
Guys who can juggle, but only a little bit?
There's a lot of guys like this. They can throw up three objects and they can keep them up for a while, but nothing tricky. They can't introduce a fourth object. They can't introduce a different object. It's this one same little thing, and that's all they've learned. I'm tired of it.
Do you juggle, by the way? I was wondering about that.
No, but I have those three soft things that you're supposed to learn with. And the big trouble I have, as everyone does, is that these things tend to go out in a plane parallel to the front of you. They tend to move outward and you start chasing them. And they tell you to juggle in front of a wall. But I've looked at that and that's really simplistic.
And then you have words and phrases we should have. And one that I kind of liked was unpark.
Yeah. So you're going to take the car and go somewhere. You're going to unpark.
And then real pretty good was another
real
one.
Pretty good. I thought of one yesterday, happifying. Something that makes you happy is really happifying.
And then the other one you had that I liked was a lot of buncha.
Yeah. So do I have an example of it there?
Yeah, you do. I only slept with her once, but now I got a lot of buncha crabs.
good. I wasn't leading you on that. I'd forgotten what I'd used.
But happifying is one of those words that actually – I mean that's one you could work in.
Yeah, you could justify that.
The impulse now you write some things and I want to take you to something else because you go through this book of brain drops and you think, oh, he's just throwing these things out, but in there are things that, well, I think you're really writing about, and
okay.
I think you mean this.
Okay.
And one of them is your essay on politically mm-hmm. correct language.
Yes.
Which you say that you're a little bit behind the curve, but you wanted to get it out.
Yeah, I felt that this has the comedians have had their day on this by the time I got to it, so I felt I should at least explain that I felt a little behind.
And before we go into some of the examples, you write, seriously, the impulse behind political correctness is a good one, but like every good impulse in America, it has been grotesquely distorted beyond usefulness.
Mm-hmm.
And do you think that it is a good one, the idea of political correctness has a good impulse?
Well, I think the impulse the impulse that there are some people – the observation that there are some people who are being treated unfairly and the impulse to correct that is good, and obviously I couldn't argue with that. But I think this is a good example, this politically correct – the way it's played out of typical white paternalistic we know best – for you minorities, how you should be treated, how you should be addressed, what the titles, the names for your groups should be, and so forth.
Now, how did that arise? Because I thought the groups that were demanding, if you listen to the talk radio, especially the groups that are demanding political correctness, are all those very groups that are, mm-hmm. well, are laying claim to their to their victim status.
I think at this stage they feel they own that, but I think they were prompted. I think there was an awful lot of prompting going on from Eastern universities, especially. And in the beginning, it was Eastern mostly.
Why? Is that really that paternalistic impulse in America, you think?
No, not in America, with white liberals. Oh. I think white liberals have privilege, and that's practically – I guess that's all of them. Educated white liberals of privilege seem to have to take the initiative in the name of other groups. I've heard some very eloquent arguments by black educated people who say, leave me alone. I don't need your help. I don't want this. And I'm not talking about strict conservative blacks either, but more liberal blacks who have said, please, we can handle this.
Well, one of the phrases you go off on is Native American.
Yes.
Which I at first I thought, well, come on, Native American. Seems like an innocent enough mm-hmm. phrase.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't see that.
First of all, there's nothing wrong with Indian.
And why is that?
Well, first of all, because that that is what they're comfortable with. I don't know many Indians who really like the term Native American. I have good friends in the American Indian movement, which is what they call themselves. There is another more or less radical Indian group that I'm sorry, I'm at a loss for the exact title. There are about four words in their title, but the word Indian is right flat in the middle of it. From what I understand, the word Indian probably originated from Columbus, who had a very poor command of Spanish, and in his reports to the king and queen, referred to the Indians as as una gente in Dios, people in God, in Dios, and that this is where the origin of Indian was, because India wasn't called India then, it was Hindustan. So I would doubt that it's a corruption of that word. But at any rate, this may be all, much to do about nothing, because what I'm really what really makes me uncomfortable is this Native American thing. I mean, first of all, the Native is wrong. They're not Natives. They emigrated here over the Bering land bridge, probably, or even ice bridge at that time, many thousands of years ago. They came from Asia. They're not Natives. No one is indigenous. There are no Natives anywhere. Everyone is a wanderer. So that's a complaint of mine. And I think putting the word American on them is the supreme insult. You know, after you come and you steal their cultures and you put them on the worst land possible and you give them blankets with smallpox on them, then to turn around and say, we're going to give you, at least in part, our own names and call you Native. It's the sad thing that I see when I see an Indian wearing a cowboy hat. I think it's just repulsive. It's just a horrible sign of defeat and complete degradation. You know, it's just it's a horrible thing what this country is based on.
If a Native American came up to you and said, I'm a Native American, would you argue with him?
No, it's his choice. And I say in the book, I don't mind I don't mind calling people by whatever name they tell me they want in one-on-one situations. I'll refer to them any way they please. That's their privilege. But as an abstract idea, I'm going to use terms that I think are honest and fair.
One more conundrum about African American, and then you write about the people that are born in other, like in Jamaica, for example.
Yeah,
moves to here.
Well, and let's not forget that Egypt is in Africa, and we don't call Egyptians African Americans when they come here and become citizens. But a black person from Jamaica, and most Jamaicans are of African origin, and they've been in the Caribbean a long time. A Jamaican who lives in Jamaica would be an African Jamaican. If we follow this liberal logic, they would be an African Jamaican. Now, if that fellow moves, I'm going to make him a fellow, okay? Now, if that fellow moves to the United States, if one of these PC people saw the African Jamaican on the street from a distance, he would think that it was an African American. But then if he got to meet him, he would find out he was an African Jamaican, unless he had become a citizen of this country already, in which case what would he be? An African American, an African Jamaican American, a Jamaican African American? And does it really matter? Because the people don't call themselves those things. Most of them say black. I've seen polls for what good they're worth that the great majority of black people prefer just black. They fought a long time to say this thing, black is beautiful. I'm black and I'm proud. They fought a long time to get rid of the other words they didn't like. So let them have that one before you go on changing, running over. Oh, we got a new name for you now. You know.
George Carlin is our guest. His book is Brain Droppings. The reason that's such an interesting conversation to have with you, a comedian, is how quickly your comedy becomes serious and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And why do you think that is?
Well, I quit high school after first year, after ninth grade. I have 9 years of what they call education in this country. I think of it more as indoctrination. But because I'm undereducated in the formal sense, I think I have some small inferiority complex in me on that. I don't think it's real prominent, but I think it's just strong enough to make me use my brain to the extent that I can sort of prove myself, that I can show everyone that the nuns were right when they said he has a good brain, he's just not using it.
But it's topics and issues that are as easily found in Harper's Magazine as in an HBO special. Mm. I mean, maybe that's just the power of comedy, but it seems like your comedy especially does that.
Well, I'm very interested in the world. I profess to say I guess we can't curse, even though this is NPR, right? But I have a little phrase: FUCK, hope. And I even though I profess that, and I've really quit the species. On the other hand, there is this longing to belong. Any loner, I think any loner and outsider has somewhere in the kernel of him the need to belong and to be accepted. And I guess my way of striving for that is to use my brain. I think I have a good mind, and I like to use it to its fullest extent. And I'm interested in these things. I think this is a drama. I think this is a comedy, but it's a drama at heart, this adventure, this cavalcade that unfolds that we're part of. This country, the whole world, I think it's going down the drain. I think it's circling the drain ever more quickly. And I'm for that, the circling and the quick emptying of this basin. But at the same time, I can't not be fascinated by
it. Now, what do you mean by that? You're for that. Because you write that all through this book. I view my species with a combination of wonder and pity, and I root for its destruction.
Yes, because I think we really blew the game. I think this magnificent species with the great potential we have, here's a brain. Here is a human brain. It can think abstractly. It can conceptualize. It can consider itself versus other things and objectify. And yet what we're doing is running around trying to get a salad shooter or sneakers with lights in them. I mean, I know I'm oversimplifying this, but I really think that the acquisition of goods and ownership of property and this relentless pursuit of power through possessions is just shameful for this magnificent brain we have. And then I think our behavior in along the way isn't so good either, how we don't mind, killing 12 or 14 million people along the way. So my reaction to that is I quit. And when I quit something, I quit for good. So I then root for the whole thing to disappear. And the second thing I want to point out is philosophers for years have said, why are we here? What is the purpose of all of this? I'll tell you why I'm here. I'm here for the show. I like a good show. This is a circus. This is a parade. This is a wonderful comedy to watch. So I root for it to get more exciting and more interesting. When there's an explosion, I want to know. I'd love to hear if they said 50,000 dead. They never do. It's always a much lesser number. And then they start finding people who are alive, and I'm disappointed. But I mean these things. Now, as best I can tell, I mean them. As best I can tell. That's the fairest I can put it.
You know, when you're up on stage, I know the lights are always shining in on the performer, but you see some of the people, and of course you hear their laughter. So do you love that audience out there?
Well, they act as a unit. That's the wonderful thing about them. And by the way, may I explain also, by way of telling you who I am, that I love individuals. I have great success one-on-one. I really see in people's faces, in their eyes, almost a hologram of the whole thing. I mean, if you really stop and want to think about it when you're looking at someone, there's just wonderful things happening in there. But as soon as they group, as soon as they clot, as soon as they begin to cluster and have a purpose and some agenda and little hats and an armband and maybe a list of people they don't like, this is when they get toxic and they lose their beauty as individuals. When I see the audience, I see a unit acting as one. An orchestra, a choir, these are exceptions. I love to, when I watch a symphony orchestra, I think, you know what I'm thinking of? I say, here are 80 or 100 people who came from different apartments and houses all over this metropolitan area. Each one had to get here a different way. They all got here and they surrendered all the individuality and they're doing this wonderful thing as a unit. That's inspiration. That's beautiful. And I can at least take some comfort in that.
But is the audience that way too? Is the audience the
inspiration?
They are
while they're there. Yes, because they're part of what I do. A comedian's work doesn't exist at all without the response. It's a constant circular thing. I give, you give, I give, you give. I wait for you, you wait for me, I wait for you. It's a wonderful thing. And it's a way also for a person such as myself who really is sort of an outsider and a loner and feels apart and did all as a child even, to have this sort of fake family, this artificial temporary family. And it's the same of the people in the airport who say hello or on the street who compliment you for something you did 20 years ago. Say, I was with my father. We saw you in Denver. You were great. This is I can't get that any other way. It's just magnificent.
When they're out in the lobby, you hear them talking. And, all these people that you're kind of lambasting are all saying, oh, that's the other guy, George. So, what do you think that means, that they get the sense of your they get the sense of your comedy, but it's never them. It's never, you're not talking about me when you're making fun of those people, are you?
I've often thought that they're sitting there, and doesn't mean us, honey. You say, all Christians suck. Not us, honey. He's talking about those people over there. I don't know about that. It's nice how people exclude themselves. That's probably human nature, too.
But it makes me wonder if perhaps it could give you some solace, some thought that maybe it's not going down the drain, that all those individuals can hear what you're saying and appreciate the irony and the satire.
Steve, you've converted me. I'm a changed man.
You're going to go out and just
from now on, I'm for everyone.
Nice comedy from now on from George Carlin. You're listening to Weekday on KUOW. George Carlin's book is Brain Droppings. Were you really a lonely child? It sounded like you had your brother around.
Well, I had my brother, but again, 5 years is a lot of age difference when you're 12 and 13 and so forth. I was happy to be alone. I cherished my autonomy. After school, I had all the time to myself. I mean, I had playmates, but they had to go home at 5 or 5:30, and my mother didn't get home from work until around 7:30. And there were a lot of nights.
It'd be illegal. That's totally not allowed today.
Isn't good? I'm glad I had it, and now they don't. I was a latchkey kid before they had the word latchkey, and she was a working mom before they had working moms. She was called a career girl. That's what they called them in those days. She was in advertising. But I cherished the nights when she'd be later than usual. I loved fixing my own spaghetti just with butter, spaghetti and butter, listen to the Lone Ranger. But so there's a there's at least a loneliness implied. It's certainly an aloneness, but probably a loneliness as well.
Was it radio? Did radio keep you company then?
Yeah, that was my. Now the phrase would be extended family. That's what it was. And I heard families that I didn't have. I heard a mother and a father, a boy and a girl, perhaps a porch, an upstairs. And we were by no means poor. We were what you might call a lower middle class, comfortable enough because my mother worked at a good job. But I didn't have a family life per se. And I sort of had one when I listened to Henry Aldrich or A Date with Judy or Corliss Archer. And the same is true of the movies of the day when they would show these Midwestern towns. And of course, I didn't know it was the back lot of 20th Century Fox. But
I guess I like thinking that radio could have had some influence on your career.
Oh, it did. It did. It gave me the power of the inside of my head, the imagination. It let me – I guess it trained me that there was a big place outside too. That was another thing that I learned, that there's a big place outside where you can go, where you can – you're inside your mind, but there's also a world that – and I used to get on the subway and sneak on the subway when I was a kid and just go all over the city by myself. I just loved it,
You're an urban person.
Yes, and yeah, through and through.
You're not a big hiker, not a big – you don't find a lot of solace in nature.
I wish that I had another life to lead starting any time, and I would love to live it all as an outdoors person because I think there's so much in that. But I've never had time or room for it. And I feel late catching up with it now. I get some of it occasionally. I get a wonderful feeling. But if I could ever have another life that was completely different from this one, it would be as a person who enjoyed being outdoors and went outdoors a lot for the sake of it.
I mean, that's kind of a Northwest ethic, right? The outdoors.
Yes,
and
yes.
So it's interesting to hear you say that.
Yeah, I'm very much envious of that. That comfort that some people have. I'm unfortunately out there, and I'm feeling like I should be somewhere else, feeling like I should be back working. Yeah,
you can't relax out there?
Not too well. There's so many things undone, it seems, And I know this is a condition. This is not a way to be, but this is my condition.
You'd have to buy all that equipment and all that gear.
All that stuff, yes, and everything's bright blue and bright pink and everything, and I don't like that.
Otherwise, it'd be all right. Do you really keep working because it's sort of driving you? It's in the back of your head, not retiring, not going to be done?
No, I have
things to do.
I have phases and things I'd like to do that are different from the way I do things now. I want to do a Broadway show that is a little more theatrical than stand-up, something closer to Lily Tomlin with production values, some staging, and characters. I want to do characters. I've neglected the characters that I have in my head, thousands of people who are only voices now. They're just sounds that I make. And these people take over when you use their voices.
How would you do that? I mean, what do you who are you creating? The time of your youth, or just people?
Well,
in your head?
I think I have a lot of ideas about a Broadway show of the type I'm describing. I haven't settled on what I'm going to do, but I think it would have to have an autobiographical strain to it somewhat. It's not there to talk about myself, but to use some center thread of my life as the jumping off point for all the other monologues and other characters that I would do. But besides that, I want to write more books. I really like this. I realized after 40 years I had been using the least efficient means of communication. I've been traveling to people's hometowns and talking to them. There has to be an easier way. Books, that's it. See, this Gutenberg, he knew. You sit down, you write it, you send it out. They go get it. They read it on their own.
Was there something more than performing that you liked about writing books? I mean, did you like putting it down between pages crafting it?
Yeah, I like the fact that I know people can read it more than once, can go back over it, and that makes you way more careful. There's a nice phrase. I like that. Way more careful. He's way more careful than I am. But to take real concern for the paragraphs and the sentences, and I just love revision. I love going back over things. I do it a lot for my writing on stage, but here I got a chance to do it, with a result I could look at.
Well, it's funny to think of a person like yourself who's so much into language and the and the absurdities of language that you're just coming to writing books.
Well, I kept saving everything thinking I would get to do it on stage, but I finally looked at it last August and I said, I'm not going to live this long to get all this stuff done because I keep adding long notes every day. So I started putting down some non sequiturs for an opening I wanted to do. I'm doing my 11th HBO show next year. And I said, I think I'd like to start with about 10 non sequiturs, just strange things. And as I got to about the eighth or ninth one, I said, you know something? This is that book I've been talking to myself about someday. So I decided just to go ahead and do it.
You write that the thing you're most proud of is those HBO specials that you've written and performed 9 solo HBO stand-up comedy specials.
It is 10 now. Yeah, I did another one this year.
Well, why? What makes those the paramount for you?
Well, because the thing I do is to stand on a stage and talk for 90 minutes. So the height of that for me is the finished product. And the finished product is never – you know, every night is slightly different and every night is very much the same. But the HBO is frozen in time. It's a professionally taped or filmed, if you will, piece of the work that will stand for a long time. It's not ephemeral like the show in the theater. And if I get it right, if I do my work for 2 years and come up with a good strong hour, then that's like a small jewel I can put on the shelf. And if I have 10 of them, which I do now, that's a tangible accomplishment that I can look at, point to, hand to someone and leave. And it's a night – you know what I like about it too? It's a line in the sand for the comedians. First you do 10 HBO shows. Then we'll talk, all right? It's, you know, there's a little ego involved. Comedians are very competitive.
America has produced some great comedians, and I just wonder how you I've always thought about what America's offered the world, and that's one thing that America has offered in this century. And I imagine that you must have been inspired by them. If you're listening to radio especially, that must have been the case. How do you see yourself among that pantheon? Without trying to be too egotistical, but how do you see it?
Well, I just take great satisfaction in knowing that if and when someone writes about the last third of the 20th century and they talk about comedy, that I can't be ignored. That's a good feeling. I also enjoy knowing that a lot of my contemporaries and peers and those who even came before me and who are still around thought well of what I did. So there's hardly much more to ask than that.
And where does the comedy, not just yours, but Benny's and all the way back, where does the comedy fit into the American culture?
Well, one of the saving graces of the American personality is that there's a good deal of, I think, the ability to look at oneself and laugh and not take the whole thing too seriously. I think there's a certain amount of that in the American personality that's attractive. And because of the rich mix in this country of peoples and cultures, I guess one of the richest mixes of comedy, of this humor, I guess is the word that's used more accurately for it. Humor always means to me it's not funny, it's just interesting. But I'll use it in this sentence.
And I read somewhere that you look at what you do and continue to do it because it's art. And you're crafting that art in the same way Picasso didn't put down his brushes. You don't stop working.
Well, not to leap too quickly to Picasso's level, but sometimes at one point here in the early 90s, I realized that I had, besides become a good entertainer, that there was an artist at work here too. And that made me very proud. And I realized that an artist has an obligation to be going somewhere, to be on a journey. And I feel that that's what I like about what I do, that I always have somewhere else I want to go with it. And when people say, when are you going to retire? And they mean well. They're just being nice. And I say, well, you wouldn't ask Picasso, when are you going to put those brushes down, Pete? Jeez, So that's the way I feel. There's always something to do. And if I get real, if I get real tired of it someday, or I can't walk, or I can't talk or think, well, we'll talk about retiring then maybe, or whatever you call it.
You don't want to be one of those comedians that are still performing past their abilities.
Or walking around the golf course wondering where their pants are. No.
George Carlin, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you for what I think of as a nice talk.
George Carlin's new book is Brain Droppings. You're listening to Weekday on KUOW.